wonderful good day and good morning to you coming here from Central Tasmania. As much as I love Tasmania and being here for the past few weeks, one of these days, I'm going to be recording a show from somewhere else. Probably relatively soon. It looks like things are sort of opening up, and I'm hoping to make it back up to the top end, to Darwin, and down through Western Australia, and back to my lovely Aotea, maybe in September, if not before. Anyway, this is Jeff Phillips Wefferson. This is On the Brink Radio, broadcast number 324. And I tried to cover the whole pandemic thing to the best of my ability. And it just got to the point where it didn't seem useful to even talk about it anymore. And I've tried to focus on really beautiful, positive aspects, not only of my life, but that relates to everybody, like in my recent shows. My last show was about my ocean friend Glenn Edney and other Jacques Cousteau of New Zealand. A return to the ocean on my part, although she's never far from me in my heart or even physically. And before that, on being an astronomer. And before that, on the ultimate technology, the beautiful gifts that we're all blessed with in terms of our minds and brains and ability to think and create and communicate, to navigate our reality. And there's so many cool, beautiful things to talk about and share. But this show, it's called The Challenge or the Art of Critical Thinking. Creating your own reality or consuming the fiction of other people. So this show is about, it's essentially about having a degree of psychological awareness to everything that's going on all the time. We can't really know what it was like to be a person, even in the previous generation, much less 100 years ago or 1,000 years ago, or even now, we can't really appreciate what it's like to be someone in a completely different culture that speaks a completely different language. And this is just of humans. You know, we can't even begin to imagine what it's like to be a non-human being. And we're still determined to impose our peoplehood on other beings. You know, what if possums went around declaring that all other beings were possums? Or rocks went around declaring that everybody else was a rock? They had the rights of rocks. They need the rights of rocks. How about that? What if a river decided that everybody else needed to be river-like? Yeah, so that's kind of like what we're doing. We're going around declaring that one of the highest things we can do is to give the rights of people to other beings. And I go like, but if you really think about that, I don't know that that's such a good idea, even from the best perspective. You know, if you look at what we do to each other. But this show is not about any of that. This show is about, it's kind of an extension of the ultimate technology that I talked about a couple of shows back, about how we've all been blessed with the sacred biological temple that our bodies are, and where we live, our minds and our spirits, and not just our body, but our whole, everybody, our whole systems that we live within, our networks of what we consist of and who we are part of, our families, our communities, our ecosystems, our planet that we live on, Mother Earth. And so to be aware of this is very empowering. Now, one of the first things I examine today is, what exactly is self-awareness, and why do we think that that's so important? Like Joan McIntyre, who wrote this really beautiful book called Mind in the Waters, she's talking about how the whales and dolphins seem to exhibit self-awareness. Like when they'll look in the mirror and realize that that's them, and that kind of thing. And I'm going like, well, being aware of that you're a self, or that you're an individual being as separate from others, we tend to think that that's a sign of intelligence or higher consciousness. And it may be a critical part of our psyche at this time, but I'm not sure how necessary that is to be truly intelligent, or if it might even be a sort of a recent development or adaptation or even mutation, a psychic mutation in our modern human psyche. Because it could be that people in other cultures that we might call primitive, but that have completely different linguistic constructs and cosmologies and worldviews, they may not be as separate from each other as we are. They may not even have so much of a well-defined, what we call, what Freud would call the ego, which is sort of like, we kind of worship that in our society, but it's sort of anti-communal to be an individual to the extent that takes primacy over being a member of a family or a group or a species or an ecosystem. So we have to have a balance of all these things. But it's something to think about in terms of our psyche. But psychological awareness means being aware of the fact that we're using our minds and brains all the time to do everything else. And like I've said before, you don't really need to know how a car works in order to be a safe and successful driver. You don't have to be a neuroscientist or a neurobiologist in order to understand how to think and create and communicate and build useful realities within your life. But so much of these processes are unconscious, and we do them unaware. And that might work. It might have worked for a long time in the world. But in the modern era, especially since the dawn of civilization, and even more since the dawn of electronically based mass communication, there's certain factions of our species who have become very aware that they can control us or manipulate us in ways that used to require guns or coercion, physical coercion, but now, in the modern era of mass communication, they can do the same thing to each other using information warfare or mass communication. So that's kind of like a central aspect of this whole thing. So your sense of self kind of determines what your horizon of identity is. And Carl Sagan, the brilliant astronomer, in one of his pamphlets about nuclear war, said that if we expand our horizon of identity, that would be one of the best ways to create a more peaceful environment on the Earth. Because if you look out and see other people or other life forms, other members of other species, and you identify with and consider that to be part of you, either you or your immediate group or family, rather than an other, you know, what they call misoniism, the fear of the other, or xenophobia, which seems to be inherent in a lot of our mentality. If you identified with everything that you see and see it as your family, what the Native Americans and the Lakota called Mitikaye Oyasin, all my relations, that's a big ticket to paradise right there. And also to be, not only to be aware of the centrality of our psychological processes that are going on all the time, also the centrality of linguistic processes that are going on all the time. That we are constantly vocalizing, like, of course, I'm talking right now, but when I'm not recording for my radio show, I don't always vocalize inside my head. I have the ability to turn that off. It's kind of a left hemisphere psychological process. So we're constantly creating the reality we have through what we pay attention to, what you remember, and what you're anticipating. So, and we're constantly navigating our way through the day and through our life. We're constantly communicating within ourselves and with other people and other beings. And communication, like Dr. Lilly said, communication is between minds. And it's also a two-way thing. So if it's just a one-way transmission, that's not really communication. It's, I'm not sure what it is, perception or transmission. So we've got navigation, communication, and model building. That's ways of creating patterns or simulations of a much larger reality that helps us to be able to grasp what's going on. Because, like the linguist Korzybski said, the map is not the territory. The map is what we create, whether it's linguistic or visual, cartographic, cognitive, or even acoustic maps. But the map is manageable to our psyche and our neurobiology, but the reality is not. It's too big and vast. And so, but we really live in the world of reality. But in our minds, we often tend to fall back on the world of maps. Before the dawn of civilization, and as it's progressed, its pervasiveness and ubiquity over the past few thousand years, we've become more accustomed to living in artificial environments, whether it's physical or psychological environments. We have gone from living out in nature, maybe in caves or little huts that we might build, or just sleeping on the ground in the grass, to living in city-states that were forts, then into cities and dwellings, and as that's progressed, and then as we've developed the ability to have recording and transmission technologies, first books and printing, and then radio and television, and then with the electrification that's made all these technologies possible, we've lived in progressively more and more artificial environments of our own creation. So rather than the world of nature and the cosmos and the archetypes of the wind and the rain and the sun and the stars and the sun and the moon and the trees and the birds and the bees, rather than all this being the content of our minds, we have now come to, as a whole, live more in artificial environments where we're constantly ingesting or assimilating electronic media. And it's a given that anything that's coming to us that's part of an artificial environment is created by other people. It's not directly coming from nature herself. It's what I call second order information. The metaphor of diet and nutrition is very important here, because a big factor in our health, our physical health, is what we eat. That's a given. That's extremely important. What we eat is what we are. But the same goes for at the mental or cognitive or psychological level. What you ingest into your mind, determines who and what you are and what you become. And if you look at patterns of this and how discriminating you are, and I use the metaphor of, we'll just turn on a television or a radio or read a magazine and just read that and assimilate it with no questions asked. Let it right into your mind and brain, and possibly not even question if it's real or true unless it just seems blatantly absurd. But you wouldn't just walk into a shop or allow a delivery truck to come to your house and somebody comes and hands you a plate of food for free, and you've never seen them before, you have no idea who they are, where they came from, or why they're doing this. Would you eat it? But that's what we do with every time we turn on the television and the radio. You're letting these interests into your own home that you're assimilating their product. So this brings me to the whole idea of critical assimilation, being critical and discriminating about what you let into your mind and your body. So I would say, if we want to define exactly what we mean by intelligence, you know, it tends to be, like if you look at behavioral psychologists and science in general, we tend to define intelligence in terms of ourself. We think that because we have hands, we've got tongues that we talk with, we can manipulate and perform engineering on the environment, that we're this gives us dominion over all the other life forms. And we've ended up being extremely destructive with all this intelligence. And so I think that one of the highest things that we've done with intelligence is to glorify ourselves. We've used our intelligence to glorify what we conceive of as our intelligence and put ourselves on a pinnacle. But I think that the necessary redefinition of intelligence, one of the central characteristics of a truly intelligent being, is that of critical thinking, the ability to use their own self-awareness to be aware of what they're choosing to assimilate, whether it's mental or physical. And therefore, that's a form of navigation, because we are creating who and what we are all the time. And critical thinking and the proper use of intelligence is also essential ingredients of mental health. That's not really the topic of this show, but it does highly relate. And so there's a lot of... Eric Fromm wrote a book in the 1960s called The Pathology of Normalcy. And he looked at how just because something is statistically normal, that psychological characteristics, doesn't mean that it's mentally sound or healthy. And I think that that's true now more than ever. In a world where people are influenced more and more by mass communication and mass media, centrally controlled and disseminated information created by other people. And the whole pandemic of the past couple of months is just like the most perfect example of all this. And it's my belief that the great danger from all this is not biological. It's not from some bug or virus that might not even really exist except as a mental or media construct, but it's the information virus disorder aspect of this whole thing. It's like coronavirus is not a biological virus as much as it is a psychological virus. It's this belief that's cognitive bogey that's sort of infected and infested every aspect of life now. And so that's really the danger. And so this is where critical thinking is the most powerful way to, if you want to use the word, vaccinate yourself. To vaccinate yourself against any kind of virus. The place to start is in the control and proper use of your mind, your creative and psychological processes. In my ultimate technology, I talk about brains, being a responsive and actively intelligent neuro-cybernetic synergist. And that's very important, especially the responsive part. Responsive, actively intelligent. Noos means mind in Greek. Cybernetic has to do with the process of self-navigation. Synergist means that you put everything together in a harmonious way. But we have to use our brains and our minds and our power of critical thinking and discrimination, because we're living in a world dominated by what I call the square of MC. That's MC in parentheses squared. This whole paradigm is what my concept of infotoxin or information toxicology is really all about, which I've written about at length and developed my website regainyourbrain.org ever since 2004. But truly, when you think about what the word dictator means, television is truly an electronic dictator, and it's a one-way communication. You can talk to the television, but is it going to listen? Is it going to feed back or communicate anything back to the cameras and the producers of the TV show? No way. So this is a huge aspect of our world that we live in, the artificial environment, the information environment. It's no longer nature. It's no longer the stars and our fellow plants and animals and life forms and archetypes of the natural world. It's the information environment. That's CNN and the BBC and all the stuff, and it can be the internet too, but it's all first order information, is that which you have experienced yourself, that you've created, or you witnessed it and ingested that yourself. It's for real. Second order information is that's been digested, pre-digested, and processed and packaged and transmitted by other people or other organizations and corporations and bureaucratic and industrial and military and commercial entities whose job it is to make you think and have the reality that they want. And so the mass media is basically the voice of the 100 largest corporations in the world. And we can add in the world of today, it's also the voice of the handful of extraordinarily wealthy people. So this is all really the same thing. You can call it the New World Order. It's sort of it's a mentality of dominion and control of other people. And so we're living in a world with unacknowledged power of centralized media. We turn on the TV to get our reality. We turn on the news. We don't even question where that's coming from. We don't realize that the news, the reason all this comes to us for free, is not only because of the adverts that are constantly shoved down your throat, but also because the programming itself is all very strategically designed and engineered and has been manipulated in this kind of way from all through the 20th century to foist what you might call Christopher Simpson in his book, The Science of Coercion. He says that it's a form of mental genetics. It's breeding whole new generations of people that only think in a certain kind of way, because they'll be the most manageable citizens of the New World Order. So it's sort of like creating mind sheep, if that's the way you want to think about it. So mass media, with the majority of people, it's just like the weather. It's like you wake up, you look outside and see if it's cloudy or sunny or raining, and you turn on the TV and the radio, and then the weather there may or may not match up with what you see out the window. But some people, I don't know, I really question whether some people, which are they going to believe? If the weather on TV tells them that it's raining where they are they going to put on their raincoat even if they look outside and see that it's sunny? So in a way, this is sort of like confusing the map with the territory, or giving the map credence over the territory. Say like you're walking along following your map, and the map tells you that there's a mountain that you have to climb right where you are, your exact coordinates. But then what you look out and see is a giant Grand Canyon Valley. And so what are you going to do? Are you going to put on mountain climbing gear or ropes to go down in the canyon? And so it's the same thing with, like, do you believe the weather on TV or the real weather when you step outside and look up at the sky? So we've got into a gray area with what we actually believe and accept as true and real. And since a lot of the stuff that we're exposed to in mass media, it's not just long ago and far away, but it's far away. It might be supposedly here and now, but it's outside the realm of our own experience. And so there's two really important aspects to that. One is, how relevant or meaningful is it for us to ingest this information or to know it, to make it a part of our psyche, to let it into our mind and brain and body, into our sacred temple? How relevant or useful is this? Which is the reason why we would, if we're critically evaluating this process, we go like, well, look, of what value is this information to me? Especially if it has a burden of gravity, you know? And then you go like, also, even if this information might be relevant or useful or affect me in some way, can I trust the source of where it's coming from? How do I know that all this is really real, or that it's happening in the way that it's being presented? I'm not there, so therefore I'm trusting the television network and the producers and the cameramen and all these different sort of variables and ways that information can be distorted. It's like what they call the Chinese whispers, but you amplify that times a million to see what happens in the world today. And all I'm saying, this is even in a world where mass media genuinely tries to convey a true sense of what's really going on. But that's very much not the case. Very much not the case. And because every media corporation is a business whose prime directive is to generate profits for their stockholders. And there's probably not even a legal requirement that any mass media is required to tell the truth, to share valid information. And in fact, what that does is the door has always been open for not only untruth and not only slight distortions of information, but for the complete fabrication of information, the complete orchestration of reality, following the admonition of Edward Bernays, where he basically said, you don't sit around and wait for news to happen. You go out and create it. So it took me a long time to realize what he meant was, but what he meant was, don't worry about if anything that you're going to share has any basis in reality. If people can see it, they'll believe it. And so what you want to do is start manufacturing consent in people's mind for the reality that the people that you're working for, the media, are businesses employed by people who hire them to sell products or ideas, ideologies, whether it's governments or manufacturers or other institutions. So this is the world we live in. But how many of us go around thinking about this stuff? How much media awareness do we actually have? How much discriminating critical thinking do we actually exhibit? So the more second order information that you take in, the greater your chances of coming down with infotoxin, with information toxicity. Like with anything, with a lot of food substances that are essential or beneficial at a certain level, they're optimum. But when you get too much, it can become lethal or toxic. Same with second order information. You know, there's high quality second order information. We've all been entertained by good movies or TV shows that has good messages and stuff like that, but we've also been traumatized and damaged by very destructive and aggressive forms of media, which almost all of it has tended to become like that in recent years. I call it cognitive aggression, but we've got not only do people become desensitized to that, some people actually come to like it. They like the sort of the brutality of watching violence on TV, even if it's simulated, like actors and stuntmen. The reptilian limbic system in your brain can't tell the difference. And so when it sees fake blood, your lower part of your brain can't tell that it's not real. So that's why you sit there glued to it. You have to keep watching, because it's the reptilian part of your brain. When it sees blood, it means either food or danger or both. And so that explains why if it bleeds, it leads. Or in Australia a few months ago, if it burns, it earns. People are almost obsessed with watching bad things happen to other people, which the Germans have a word for, Schadenfreude. So mass media makes that possible, and also the whole concept of misery loves company. People want to see bad things happening to other people because it might be not as bad. It might be worse than what they feel like is happening to them. So all of these are part of the psychic component of people's obsession with mass media. But I think, and another thing too, you know, you have to ask, when you're critically assimilating something, you ask, is it relevant or useful for me to know this or to have this in my mind? Is it verifiable? Are the sources credible? Can this possibly be real or true? Then you go beyond that, you go like, well, is this even logically possible? This whole thing, like the whole thing with, like, for example, I've been watching over the past few years the increasing rolling out of every possible infotoxin mind management technique, and it really started peaking out with the climate change thing and with during the bushfires in Australia a few months ago. But then now with the whole coronavirus thing, it's all just gone to even the next level. It's got to the ad nauseum level of every trick in the book, especially just the purely mechanical technique of repetition. You just repeat something over and over again, and it becomes an ingrained part of people's minds. So the words coronavirus or COVID-19 has just become, it's a parasitic virus imprint that's been stamped onto our brains through just incessant repetition, and then tied in with the whole fear thing of people worried about getting sick from some bug, and then the whole people being concerned with all the bureaucratic malfeasance associated with this. And it's just it's been a circus of infotoxin. And I think that truly the most helpful thing that anybody can do right now is just get all that stuff out of your system. Pretend like it doesn't even exist, because it probably doesn't. As a media artifact, as a psychic implant, as a viral infection of the mind, yes, it's real, but only to the extent that you let it. And, you know, it's sort of like if you're walking around in a world of zombies, you might know that you're safe yourself, but you've got to watch out for what the other people might do that are infected with the zombie virus. They might all of a sudden decide they do want to eat your brain. And so then what are you going to do? You're going to have to look like a tree. So this kind of thing, you've got to be able to protect yourself, not from any kind of biological virus, but from the effects of what other people think. So this is kind of like the dominant thing in the world that we're living in right now. It doesn't have to be this way. If we've all had critical thought and discriminatory assimilation of ideas and information, we wouldn't have nearly got to this far with the whole scenario. And then another comment on mass media. If you just logically think about how big the world is, even just the world of people, how many countries there are, how many people there are, how many different people, how many different things that people are doing every day. We do a lot of the same things, but there's many, 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 almost an infinite number of variations, different cultures, different things happening. And when you think of how many events are shared on, like, the news every day, it's only a handful. And so when you think of, out of all the possible events in the whole world that news teams could be aware of and could be telling you about, there's billions. So why is it that every day you see the same thing. You might see an accident, you might see international terrorism, you might see some biomedical bureaucrats arguing, you might see some leaders being stupid, and you might see it's like the guy that ate at McDonald's every day for a month. He's supersized. He had to, if they asked if he wanted supersized, he had to do it. So he ate at McDonald's 3 meals a day for a month. So that's what humanity is really doing now on mass media. They're supersizing themselves with mass media, and we're all getting cognitive obesity, and the destruction of our cognitive liver through the ingestion of fat, not alcohol, but fat. That was what the guy's doctor had supersized me. He couldn't believe that someone could destroy their liver so much just by fat, not alcohol. So we're ingesting the toxic fat of mass media, and it's eating our brainstem to where people are just becoming kind of like uncritical zombies walking around and allowing themselves to be successfully manipulated and mentally, genetically engineered by the powers that be to become citizens of the New World Order. Because if everybody thinks, can't think outside the box, no one ever needs to point a gun at you to control your behavior. So this whole coronavirus thing, as a segue from climate change, I mean, literally, we went from Greta Thunberg and David Attenborough to the bushfires that verified the whole climate change paradigm in a lot of people's minds, straight from that into the coronavirus thing, which has created a lot of bureaucratic malfeasance, and then now the whole violence thing, like especially in America. So it's like, what's coming next? I saw a very funny little cartoon. It showed a bunch of sort of gray aliens, you know, people, and they're saying like, oh my God, we're up next. I'm very nervous. And so they're talking about the whole idea of a fake alien invasion being staged by the powers that be. This has been in the cards all through the 20th century, and for a long time, everything about aliens was the dominant thing back in the time of Steven Spielberg and E.T. and all that. And then you really look at the whole Roswell, the history of UFOs, the Roswell incident in 1946, right when the CIA was created, and the implantation of that whole meme. And so that's still there. And with all the stuff with space, with Elon Musk and SpaceX and the Space Fence and Lockheed and all these satellites and lasers and holograms and stuff like that, it's not impossible that a fake alien invasion scenario could still be in the works. So what they're trying to do, the Club of Rome talked about how they were looking for the right enemy to create in people's mind, that so they could fight against that enemy and unite humanity in this fight against the evil enemy. And they decided on global warming, which morphed into climate change. They decided on that to be one of their evil enemies. And then Zbigniew Brzezinski talks about how persisting social crisis and the battle against that, the perceived battles against that, the solutions, which is the, for example, for the coronavirus, it's the global ID passport vaccine with the tracking and all that different kind of stuff. So all these are problems that have been created whose solution is what the powers that be want. So if you're critically thinking, you've been aware of this all the time. So one of the biggest things that you can do is to fast from mass media. Stop ingesting all this stuff at all. You don't have to even be critical about it. Just turn it all off. Go for hours or days or weeks without watching any TV or news or even going online. And I just sometimes feel a lot better when I do that myself. I do this weekly radio show, but it's very much of a sense of duty to try to help people to be aware of the beautiful gifts that we have. But beyond critical thinking and discriminatory assimilation of other people's reality, why not create your own? That's the true definition of an artist, someone that who creates their own reality. William Blake, one of my favorite minds, he said, I must create a system or be enslaved by another man's. And what he's talking about the uncritical assimilation of, for example, a religious belief system that the people of his day were being forced to worship the God of the Anglican Church. And that's a big reason the colonists left for America, so they didn't have to be a member of the religion that the Crown of England told them. So that's why my partner Elizabeth Verstraeten and I, when we made our first film, we called it Cryo 2008, C-R-Y-O, which is like the Greek word for frost, cold, but it's also very cool to create your own reality. C-R-Y-O, creating realities of your own. That's really what the ultimate technology is all about. And we've got that. We're doing it all the time. But if you input fake information and fictional information from other people and other organizations, not only do you walk around with distorted realities, you also become their product, like the Adbusters ad. The product is you. So we're all on the verge of becoming a complete product of modern civilization, not really the true people of one heart, the human beings that we were really meant to be on the true path of the Great Spirit. But to the extent that we walk around being afraid of coronavirus and being worried about climate change and worried about how much money you've got and all this different kind of stuff, that's not being truly intelligent. Truly intelligent means to be critically thinking, to constantly be aware of what you're ingesting, what you're doing, where you're going, how you're navigating, how you're using your time, and asking if you're being of service to the greater good, to all of humanity, to all of life, and to constantly be seeking to reprogram and renavigate how you're living to ever higher levels. This is all qualities of a truly intelligent beings in order to bootstrap ourselves out of the abyss, the brink of the abyss on where we stand right now. I think that the highest purpose of awareness is gratitude. The more aware you are, the more thankful you are for being aware, and for what you're aware of, the beauty and power of being here now. Whereas we've chosen to use our highest form of intelligence is self-adulation, self-aggrandizement. Oh look, these other species, look, the whales and dolphins, they can recognize themselves in the mirror. They must have intelligence, or they can mimic, they can realize that this little symbol means to go and get that ball. So, you know, this is just so ridiculous. If we just sort of shut down a big part of our minds and brains and just sort of drunk in the beauty and power of the stars and the ocean and the mystical wonder of being here now, we might become who we really are. Us. This is Jeff Phillips Weffers signing off for On the Brink Radio. Live simply so that others may simply live. Thank you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.